happen and to continue even with setbacks. And I think that's inspiring. And again, the fact that she was an outsider in much of her life, even after she became a doctor, she wasn't fully accepted into the mainstream. I think that touches many of us who have felt or maybe still do feel to be outsiders in this community, this population today. And I think she's showing, you know, a really great example of how to proceed and how to endure.
Okay, well said. I want to thank our guest, Michael Hellquist, LGBTQ historian and author of the book Marie Equi, Radical Politics and Outlaw Passions. And you can learn more about Michael and his writing at the website www.michaelhellquist.com. That's H-E-L-Q-U-I-S-T, michaelhellquist.com. And also thanks to our intrepid engineer, John Riley.
And that program was brought to you on recording, unlike that flub. You're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, vibrating 99.5 million times every second. Whoops. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Despite all of those attributions, we're going to be spending the morning talking about Star Trek. No, that's not fair. But we have a fabulous, encyclopedic panel waiting for you, consisting of Dan Persons, Ren Sims, Keith DeCandido, Keith R.A. DeCandido, I should say, and John Ordover. But there'll be announcements first, so stay tuned. And once again, good morning. So, yeah, this would be normally the point where I would play Dan's review for the morning, which, in fact, we are set up to do. But, oh, yes, that looks correct. And then maybe music and then start talking. And then I would say, oh, wait, I have announcements. But I need to get those announcements in. So what I thought I would do is start with the announcements, do them all, because there's a bunch of them. And they'll take, you know, 5 minutes or so, he said, hopefully. And then we will go to Dan's pre-recorded review. And then we will open up to our panels. And time permitting, we'll even open up to you. We are not doing a Facebook Live this morning because last week we had the great advantage of having Madeline Flieger was here, and she was engineering. So I was actually able to set up my brand new wonderful little phone with what is currently the best camera available on a phone until the next model comes out, which is on Wednesday. Seriously, it comes out October 4th. So now probably everybody knows which phone I'm talking about, but who cares? No, it's not an iPhone. I don't do that. At any rate, but it's got fabulous camera, 18 megapixels and HDR plus. It's really, really cool. But so I've been doing Facebook Live, and it's really been sort of fun when we can stay on camera. But with four people in the room, myself included, and Dan Persons on the phone, not going to be easy. I will take photographs and stuff and either post them later or else put them on, or else even post them via Instagram or something. The new interface on Instagram really, really sucks. That's my review. So at least on an Android phone. So stories, you can't post pictures anymore. You post stories. The wonderful soundproofing here at WBAI. What's really cool is when the motorcycle gangs come off the Belt Parkway and go up Atlantic Avenue and somebody's reading a story on the air. And all the, you just hear the gang going up Atlantic Avenue. Okay, announcements that I said I would make. Those weren't them. Unfortunately, we're starting with obits. One, which I only learned about since I got into the station about an hour ago. Apparently, Hugh Hefner has died. And that is a shame. And that is significant to the world of science fiction because a great deal of some brilliant and great science fiction came out both in Playboy magazine and through Playboy Press, which put out a lot of excellent anthologies. I think they did novels. They did, John Ordover says, yes, they did novels.
Among them, Footfall by Niven and Pornell.
They did Footfall? That was Playboy Press, really? Yep. Wow, I had no idea. Okay, so At any rate, so we note the passing of Hugh Hefner, and yes, it has an impact in the world of fantastic literature. Secondly, and more not as well known, but more directly to the world of science fiction, Kit Reed, who was a guest on this program 3 times, I think, once live and twice recorded. And at the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, I don't know, 4 times or so, including at Mr. Ordover's former establishment, the Soho Gallery for Digital Art. And she was very appropriate for that because her science fiction was always on the intersection of humanity and technology in very strange and wonderful ways. And she was a very strange and wonderful woman. She was 85 years old, so therefore younger than Hugh Hefner, actually. And both of them had good, well-lived long lives and have left a body of work, in the case of Hefner, all kinds of bodies of work and play behind them. But I have a lot of air checks and stuff of Kit Reed, and I will figure out when we are going to do a proper celebration of her life. Next Monday at 3 p.m., from 3 to 5 p.m. here on WBAI, with James Ursay as host and Janet Coleman as celebrant, we're doing my 50th anniversary here at WBAI. I began on May 1st, 1967, so it's been 50 and a half years. It's 50 years. And I should note that October of 1967, I have to talk to people that are here actually about this, because I want a 4-hour show. That will be the 50th anniversary of The Star Pit by Samuel R. Delaney, and I can get Chip on the air, and we can have a premium and fun drive and all kinds of stuff like that. So, and I know that easily because outside of the fund drive that I was working on when I came in as a volunteer in 67, in May of that year, it was later on that I came back and helped. Essentially, I made the Star Pit that Delaney was working, that Baird Sills produced, happen because, you know, who's going to fetch the coffee? Who's going to bring the water? Who's going to roll the joints? I mean, you know, this thing is going to have to get done somehow. And so without me, that would never have occurred. So that's this coming Monday, October 2nd at 3 p.m., 3 to 5 p.m., daylight hours at 99.5 FM. Open your ears and get out your wallets. Yes, it's the fund drive, in addition to being my 50th anniversary. That's Monday. Tuesday will be the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings event. And that's Tuesday, October 3rd. And we'll have two Philadelphians on. Michael Swanwick, who is a semi-regular at the series. I'm very pleased with that. It's so wonderful that he comes down so often to do the series. And Michael Swanwick, for those who don't know, I'm not going to do the whole bio. He has a good long one. Google it, mofo, as they say. But I will tell you that, let's see, he's had over 150 stories between Amazing, Analog, Asimov's, Clark's World, High Times, New Dimensions, on and on and on. Many are reprinted in Best of the Year anthologies, several hundred works of flash fic, many languages, a whole bunch of nonfiction books that are worthwhile, 10 novels, including the forthcoming The Iron Dragon's Mother, which finishes his fantasy trilogy, which is one of the best I've ever read. The Iron Dragon's Daughter, the Dragons of Babel, and soon to come, The Iron Dragon's Mother, which I'm very anxious to read. And then Gardner Dozois. It's been at least 10 years since Gardner has appeared. He was a regular at the series and at the KGB reading series. He is a friend to us all, especially when he lived in New York. But even when he didn't live in New York and moved to Philadelphia, he would come here fairly regularly. But due to circumstances and health issues, Gardner has been out of the circuit for, well, more than a decade. I saw him at the Nebula Awards this year. Where I have to say it every time, where my partner was a finalist. Barbara Krasnoff was a finalist for a Nebula Award for Best Short Story. Yay! And Sabbath Wine, Aspirate by name. And the And I saw Gardner there, and we solidified things and all that. And Gardner was the editor of Asimov's magazine for 20 years. He also edits the annual anthology series, The Year's Best Science Fiction, which has won the Locus Award for Best Anthology more than any other anthology series in history. Oh, I was going to mention about Swanwick. He has been nominated between the World Fantasy Award, the Nebula Award, and the Hugo Award more than anybody else in the history of science fiction fantasy. And as Michael puts it, that means that he has lost more often than anybody in science fiction history. I had to mention that because that he says that all the time, and I think it's just, it tells you a lot about his character. Getting back to Gardner, blah, blah, blah. He's won the Hugo Award 15 times as the year's best editor, won the Locus Award 31 times, including an unprecedented 16 times in a row as best editor, and has won the Nebula Award twice, as well as a Sidewise Award for his own short fiction. He's author and editor of more than 100 books, including a novel written in collaboration with George R. R. Martin, whoever he is. And in addition to many solo anthologies, Songs of the Dying Earth, Warriors, Dangerous Women, Rogues, all co-edited with that same George Martin. I don't know what happened to that guy. He used to live in Hoboken and then just sort of disappeared, playing some kind of D&D game of something or other, I think. Well, enough of that. Although I kept to the 15 minutes, including the opening theme that I claimed I would. So, with Dan on Skype and people in the studio, I think that means that it's time to go to a recording, don't you?
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Okay, I was going to discuss What Happened to Monday, the quite good film currently on Netflix that has Noomi Rapace playing identical septuplets sharing the same identity in a world where no family can have more than one child. But after this Sunday, I feel I'm honor-bound to talk about the return to air of the TV show that presently stands as one of the greatest SF series currently airing. I'm talking, of course, about Rick and Morty, which will have its season finale on Adult Swim this Sunday, and this year has brilliantly used its dimension-spanning universe to explore the disastrous consequences following Rick's orchestration of his daughter Beth's divorce from her husband Jerry. And no, I'm not kidding. If you haven't been watching this show, you've been missing some of the best, most disturbing, and most moving SF on TV. The show's available through various on-demand platforms. It's one of the few I'd say is worth paying for whole seasons, because while it doesn't really have defined seasonal arcs, the characters do grow and develop, and you do need to see the early reps to understand the impact of what's going on in later seasons. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons. Star Trek Discovery? Oh, you want to hear about that? Okay, here we go. Akiva Goldsman sucks rubber donkey lungs, okay? No? Oh, all right. There are two problems with Star Trek Discovery. The first is one you're probably expecting me to address. For someone steeped in old-school Trek, it is difficult to accept the fact that CBS/Paramount has recognized that the previous run of series that ended with Enterprise was suffering from iron poor blood and needed to be retooled to attract a generation that didn't give two tribbles about Trek, and then went ahead and did just that. This doesn't look like Trek. This doesn't feel like Trek. Even the massive retooling J.J. Abrams did for the feature franchise still felt like an extrapolation from the original series. Discovery is totally divorced from that. You could slap an original title on it and just change a few bits of Trekkian terminology, and you could push it out as an original show. But if it was just a case of complete and utter overhaul, then I would have been able to tell myself, okay, Dan, just suck it up and go with what's been handed to you. So let me get to the real problem. This cliff-hanging first episode, and I've only seen the first episode because after it, I'm not inclined to even run the risk of my week-long free trial of CBS All Access running out and me having to pay $5.99 for the privilege. The first episode of Star Trek Discovery is awful. The dialogue is atrocious. The characters, with few exceptions, prime among them Doug Jones's alien science officer, are poorly defined. The narrative, which involves a confrontation between a Federation vessel and, I think, I'm not sure, a Klingon warbird, and leaps between the two to no great end, is close to incoherent. And towards the end of the episode, one of the main characters commits an act that no well-trained officer, which should be the only kind that Starfleet puts out, would ever dare consider. The look of the show conjures to mind producer Akiva Goldsman's work on the atrocious Lost in Space movie, Dark and Unpleasant. The camera roves pointlessly, and when it stays still, has a preference for odd setups. Just because space has no up and down doesn't mean everything has to be Dutch angles. An hour of television shouldn't be this much of a trial to get through, unless maybe it's Twin Peaks, The Return, and I'm still reserving judgment on that. The pilot for Star Trek Discovery was painful to watch, and much as I kind of feel I should see if the second half of the story clears away the clouds of the first half, the incompetence that's on display isn't providing me with sufficient impetus to carry on. Meantime, I've been picking my way through the most recent two eps of The Orville, and I'll admit this may just be a knee-jerk reaction to what Discovery did to me, but I am seeing glimmers of hope there, particularly with the most recent episode, centered around two alien crew members struggling over having their baby undergo a culturally mandated sex change. That the couple are both males and the baby female, and that McFarlane and company were willing to take the issue to a surprising but believable conclusion, demonstrates potential in the show that wasn't particularly evident in the pilot. It'd be ironic if Seth MacFarlane's highly budgeted fanfic exercise is the Star Trek series that Discovery fails to be. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons, hashtag ITMFA.
Yeah, and at some point, and actually I've got Dan on the phone right now via Skype. Dan, are you there?
Yep, and that kid really knows what's going on. Yes, sir.
Okay, what the hell is... Yeah, right. What the hell is ITMFA? I tried to Google it. I got nowhere.
I can't say it fully on the air, but it's impeach the MF already.
Oh, mofo.
Mofo, yeah.
Oh, okay, fine. Very good. So, let us... before... I don't know that we're going to dissect your review. I think there are lots of different opinions here. I will. I of course will, because I get to do that every week. And before I introduce everybody else,
usually
I will.
When I'm not around to defend myself.
Yeah, well, that's the point, isn't it? And I can still turn down the pot, but by that I mean the potentiometer. But the main thing is that. I agreed with you. I really had a lot of problems with a lot of what occurred in the first half of the episode, because really what it is it's a two-hour pilot, and they only showed you half, and they kept the other half at bay. And I finally did go out and acquire the second half of the pilot. And I have to say, I thought it was quite good, the second half. It really, at the end of it, I thought, oh my God, it's a new chapter in Shrek. It really is. It's really legitimate. And they didn't show any signs of that in the first half. And they hurt themselves a lot in doing that, because a lot of the reaction that I have seen from friends on Facebook and social media and various places has been, well, I'm not going to pay to see the rest of that thing. And no, they should have just shown that whole pilot, you know, with the crew that's, you know, largely not going to be there. So they're going to do, I think, as John or Keith or, well, somebody who we're about to introduce pointed out, we're going to have to do another whole pilot.
It's the strategy that they're doing here is obvious, but it's the wrong strategy.
I agree.
They you really have to be sure that your story is solid if you're going to leave people hanging like that, and you can't. And it would have been better if people had said, wow, that was a great story. I want to see what happens next.
Well, except they did. Lots and lots and lots and lots of people signed up for CBS All Access on Sunday.
Did they really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They have not released the numbers on that.
No, yet. But the...
Well, you don't know that.
You
don't know that any more than you know how many people have watched something on Netflix.
Yeah.
But... And nobody knows how many people signed up.
Well, we'll find out how many people watched the show... when we see whether or not it goes for a second or third season.
That's
how it works with Netflix, too.
That is exactly right.
Then one of the nice things about a streaming service is that, from the company's point of view, is that they know exactly how many people watched it.
And they know exactly what tier.
And also at whether or not they turned it off 10 minutes in and never started it again, they know they have all the data.
Okay. Yeah. So that was a previous... show.
I will suspect we'll know even sooner how well the show did by how soon it actually winds up on broadcast.
It'll go to Netflix first. It's already on Netflix outside of the U.S. Yeah. They're not doing the CBS All Access thing in the U.S. or Canada, but it is in other...
And they can afford to be patient. They've already made the deals... internationally to do this stuff, so they can wait to release it on home video or broadcast or whatever domestically until after it's all aired on all.
It'll probably go to streaming, and by streaming I mean not CBS streaming.
Yeah.
And oh my God, do I have a bone to pick about that? But I will. It's not about Star Trek. It's about CBS streaming. Yeah. FX now is putting all of their stuff, and they've got quite a body of stuff, including Fargo and Legion and a lot of good shows that are going to FX Plus, I believe is the name of the service.
Yeah.
So you've got
It's a major fallacy, this...
You didn't like
Legion. This a la carte model.
Yeah.
That they're working on now. The idea that you're going to pay $3.99 here... and $5.99 here.
It's $5.99 here. HBO is like $12.
Here's what will happen. Everything will splinter off until eventually you're supposed to be paying individually for every show you want to watch.
And then
the flip side will occur again. People will start selling packages that, for example, if I want to only watch the science fiction TV, someone will sell a science fiction package. That includes shows from CBS, NBC, ABC, and every other network, probably Galactica. Except Sci-Fi, which won't be producing any science fiction.
Yeah. Well, they never have, so why start now?
Yeah,
but I totally agree with John, and something I thought of earlier is instead of cutting you're going to cut the cord, but you'll be end up with a lot of little strings.
Yeah.
Well, it's actually more or less what satellite TV was back in the, early 80s.
My father
had a giant dish in the backyard, and he paid by individual channel.
Yeah,
but I wouldn't mind the pay-by-the-show model, sort of like drop the meter and do I want to watch this show? Okay, here's a quarter or a dollar or whatever.
Which is what iTunes is doing right now anyway.
But speaking of Star Trek Discovery...
Before we speak of Star Trek Discovery, let us speak of Hour of the Wolf and who are the guests on it.
Oh, yeah.
Who are these people?
Who am us, anyway? As far as Hein Theater would say, Dan is, besides being movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf, Dan?
Yes, sir.
You're a columnist looking for a column.
I did work for CineFantastique and CineFantastique Online. I've done some stuff for IFC. That's way in the past. There are Glimmer's about Cinefantastique that I can't really talk about at the moment. And also, for a while I've had my own podcast, Mighty Movie Podcast, which is the episodes of which are still available over at mightymoviepodcast.com.
Very good. John Ordover.
I worked in publishing for about 25 years, and then I needed to make money. So I went and did other things.
John, do me a favor. Tap your microphone. Okay. Keep doing that for a moment.
Okay.
I want to isolate. Ah, I found it. Okay, very good. No.
Okay, I got the laughter.
I said tap it. Don't throw it to the floor.
That was beautiful. For those listening at home, John threw his microphone to the floor.
No, it fell off.
He had his drop the mic moment.
He tapped it and it dropped itself.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, that's not going to help much.
Okay.
John, you need to... Okay, hold on. Let me go over.
Let the tech person handle it.
Drop this thing, this cube thing we have here. Okay, let's get rid of that. And there. Now you have my... Now I had my mic. This is like a Three Stooges episode, gang.
This is actually funny.
This is similar.
Right. Well put.
I worked at, I said,
as a publisher, what did you publish, John?
Well, I was an editor.
Right.
Probably the thing I'm most known for is that I edited the Star Trek novels from 1992 to 2003. And the thing I am least known for is I hired Keith R. Day to Canada to write some of them. And he kept doing that far longer than anyone should have let him. But he actually seemed to have a following, which nobody predicted. Not even me when I hired him.
Okay.
That is my. I also wrote a couple of episodes, or rather, co-wrote a couple of episodes
of DS9.
Of DS9 with David Mack, who has just released the novel Star Trek Discovery. What's it called? Desperate Hours,
which just went on sale today,
and is getting very good reviews from people who read it, and even better ones from people who haven't yet.
Okay. Very good. Ren.
I don't know what I'm doing here. let's see. I have been helping run conventions for the past, or science fiction conventions for the past 30 years. Mostly I keep in the background. There's a four-letter initial for initials for people like me. I stick my nose into things, and I...
For those who don't know, a Smoth is a secret thing. Master or... of fandom.
Yes. And I married this other idiot here, you know.
Not John? Me, the other idiot.
The other idiot.
Of the other idiot.
That's really about it. I do work in publishing now, mostly nonfiction and children's books and layout. I'm supposed to be doing it for some other people, but that keeps on getting put off. But that's okay. It's after a weird history. But anyway, I'm going to shut up now.
That seems unlikely.
Yeah,
I'm Keith R. DeCandido. I'm the guy she married. By the way, what she didn't mention is she's also done editorial work for several different publishers, including Dark Quest Books and Riverdale Avenue Books, and some others. I'm Keith R. DeCandido. I've written a bunch of Star Trek fiction, which isn't. Started out being entirely the fault of Mr. Ordover over there, who first hired me.
That was at Simon & Schuster / Pocket Books,
yes,
right?
That was at Simon & Schuster. Although I also have done Star Trek comic books for both Wildstorm and IDW.
Okay.
And I continued to write Star Trek after John left, which was a considerably more pleasant experience. And for those listening at home, John and I have been friends for almost
30
years.
Oh.
The mutual
until
abuse.
20 minutes ago.
Yes. The mutual abuse is kind of part of our thing.
And
we actually do.
This is how we started talking to each other when we first met.
Actually,
and
we first met. Anyway.
Yeah.
But I've written a whole lot of Star Trek fiction. More recently, I have been doing. I just actually finished doing extensive rewatches of the original Star Trek, Next Generation, and Deep Space Nine for Tor.com.
Now explain to listeners what a rewatch is.
Basically, I watch the episode again, and then I write about the episode, both discussing the plot, the character developments, and various other things. And then
it's sort of a hindsight review.
Yeah. It's in-depth reviews and examinations of the individual episodes. I just finished the original series, which was mostly ran through last year, which was the 50th anniversary. And it included not only the live-action series, but also the animated series and all the movies. And currently I am reviewing Star Trek Discovery for Tor.com. My review of the first two episodes went live on Monday, so if you've already read those reviews, you're probably going to hear me repeat myself a bit today.
Oh, that's all right. So I think we have covered Who Am Us.
Yes.
And I think now we can... We have heard Dan's initial reaction and mine, which was... wait and see. I will say one thing. I really, really, really like Jason Isaacs as an actor. He has had so many TV series, both here and in the UK. He had a series called Case Histories, which I don't think ever played here. If it did, it was on Acorn TV or something like that. And I thought that was very good and cut off after like six episodes. He had a science fiction series where he had two personalities, one who was asleep and one who was awake. And he had two psychiatrists, one of whom was Michael Dorn, as a matter of fact, and just Worf, for those people who aren't Trek experts. Trexperts.
I've been called that.
And he had, oh God, he's had about four different TV series. He is probably, for those people who really pay attention, best known for playing Malfoy's father, Lucius Malfoy, in the Harry Potter series, which is, you know...
And on Star Trek Discovery, he plays...
He hasn't been on yet.
There we go.
He will be. Well, he will be playing the captain of the of the Discovery.
Yeah, he's the captain.
I know.
Based on the previews, is going to be the one to break, to get Burnham furloughed. Michael.
Yeah. At any rate, the point is that I really like him, and if nothing else, I hope that this is a breakthrough for him on a show that lasts more than eight episodes, because that hasn't really happened for him yet.
Well, that's pretty much guaranteed.
Yes, because they're doing 15 this season.
Yeah. I thought they were only doing eight.
They bumped it to 15.
It's 15, yes.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
well.
And that's basically guaranteed.
When did they bump that?
I don't remember.
Okay, then at least one or two of the articles that I had were outdated.
There's a recent article that said 15.
Okay.
And in much the same... It's interesting that they're doing this, you know, to help turn CBS All Access into a thing. Paramount and CBS have been doing this sort of thing over and over again. I mean, they were originally Paramount was planning to launch their own network in the 70s with Star Trek as its flagship. They wound up abandoning that and instead turned it into the motion picture. When Next Generation debuted, there was no such thing as a first-run syndicated drama in 1987, really.
Right.
And then they decided to do that with Next Generation, which guaranteed them a full season no matter what. And it wound up opening the door to 8 million syndicated shows. I mean, there was a wonderful renaissance of particularly genre shows in the late 80s and early 90s that only tapered off because cable stations and other networks started rising up to take their place instead. And now they're doing... And then, for that matter, in 95, when Paramount really launched a network, semi-successfully with the United Paramount Network, which eventually got absorbed into Warner Brothers, they launched it with Star Trek Voyager. So there's a history of this, of them using Star Trek to try to launch, you know, some new platform.
It's so weird for me to hear people say Star Trek Voyager, because I always say V'ger.
Yeah. Okay. No, that was seven. That was the last time they completely redesigned the Klingons and didn't explain it.
but the thing about...
The only line I can think of is, we don't like to talk about it.
If it weren't... Yes, it is annoying to have to pay for something that you used to get for free. Everybody's annoyed by that. There's no reason not to be annoyed by it. But we have to keep in mind that if it weren't for CBS wanting to use a Star Trek to launch CBS All Access, this would not have happened at all, in my opinion.
Well, so, I disagree.
Well, you're wrong.
you say that, John, and sorry. No, you're wrong, and I'll tell you why. Because if they didn't do it, Netflix would do it. Amazon would do it. These people are going deep, deep, deep into their pockets. This series is hardly the most expensive for any of those networks, with Amazon doing The Man in the High Castle and issuing, what is it, for next year, $5 billion in production. Netflix double that? No. It would have been purchased, produced, and broadcast, and the consumers would not have to choose a la carte. They would be able to choose this dinner or that dinner. There are three primary dinners at this point. Hulu, which I don't like to go near because it's Fox and other reasons, and because they don't have enough, you know, The Handmaid's Tale is the only thing there that attracts me. And then you've got Netflix, which has everything from Black Mirror to a lot of really decent stuff in general, although I'm so upset that they let go of all the classic movies that they used to have. And Amazon Prime, which picked up most of the movies that Netflix dropped and is producing...
And is doing Men in the High Castle and...
Yeah, which is shockingly decent. It had Ridley Scott associated with Philip K. Dick, which are usually, for me, not a good combination. But having said that, I think that he's done a brilliant job.
And it was the only major Philip K. Dick work that hadn't been adapted yet, and it's my favorite of his, so I was really glad they found it.
Well, it's his best, I think. Yeah. I think. Anyway. There are a lot of other major Philip K. Dick works that nobody's adapted, although a number of them have been ripped off. Passengers is, I hope I shall arrive soon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Only with a really worse ending. And doesn't have
jumping
cat in it. Yeah, go on.
Jumping back to Discovery, I think there was something that
I was just countering, though, what John was saying, that, no, there's no reason for CBS All Access to exist for one network only when you have a conglomerate, three major conglomerates of network.
But CBS has a sufficient back catalog, that, which I'm surprised that Al Access
is... Twilight Zone.
Yeah, that they're not taking nearly enough advantage of, to my mind. I mean, the whole point of doing it themselves is to take advantage. CBS has as much back catalog as anybody.
Yeah, and Fox is going to have even more, actually.
Yeah, because of the connection with 20th Century Fox.
But back to what we thought of Star Trek Discovery.
Yeah.
But the form, I think, is problematic.
Let me just throw in here that my plan is, and it's good to hear Jim say the second part is an improvement, and I'm guessing that John and Keith are going to concur with that. My plan is to give this a couple of months and then sign up to CBS All Access for the free one-week trial and just run through a bunch of the episodes and see then.
The whole thing,
which I think is how they're – I mean, from the looks of it, it looks like it's being in much the same way that a lot of the Netflix series have been written, are designed to be told in a single arc.
Well, the way they structured the Netflix show, this episode that comprises the first and second parts, right, this episode would have been the fourth or fifth episode of the Marvel Netflix show, for example, because that's when they do the flashback to to the origin.
I think he's right on that. Yeah.
But basically, my reaction to the whole hour, the whole 2 hours rather, was
the pilot,
and for that matter, yes, it's a pilot. But my reaction to it was, wow, it's the 30th anniversary of TNG's pilot, basically, and Star Trek has been disappointing me in its pilots for 30 years. And this is no less disappointing than Voyager. Then now, Encounter at Farpoint is sort of a creature unto itself. Wait, no pun intended.
Thank God.
But even the Deep Space Nine premiere was not great. The Voyager premiere was not great. The Enterprise premiere was not great. And I think this comes in somewhere in the middle of the pack. There's any number of flaws with what offended me, and particularly my wife, who particularly disliked the show most, was in that first hour, the supposedly strong women who are in command are stripped of agency. They don't make a decision, a move, or a choice without running and discussing it with the man and then doing what the man wants them to do. And if you're going to set up females in command, you have to let them be the decision makers, let them be self-motivated. I mean, let me put it this way. How many times have we seen Kirk break out of a jail? And so she's in the brig, and she can't even occur to her to try and get out of the brig until Sarek says, why don't you get out of the brig, basically. And that's just part of it. What I had said before was continuity.
And she's rather shocked that he says that, though.
All continuity to one side. And that, you know, you can't really put it one side with Star Trek. I understand why they want to, but putting all continuity to one side. What I said beforehand was whatever the Klingons look like, whatever else they do, however the time frame doesn't match up, is the story there? And when I start to sound like Harlan Ellison, I start to worry, but is the story there? Is the writing there? And to me, the answer was very definitely no. Certainly, if I had been still editing the book line, I would have loved this because it gives you 7 years on the Shenzhou to play with.
Which is, in fact, what the first novel.
Which is what, in fact, David Mack's first novel, which is called
Desperate Hours.
Desperate Hours, which I can't remember, but Keith Fortune
can. M-A-C-K.
David M-A-C-K.
Yes.
Is about, but... And that's great, but why we had that whole setup and getting to know the characters, which in fact, here's what I approved of in the show. I approved of the fact that they jumped right into the middle of a pre-existing characters and a pre-existing crew that already had a relationship with each other. To my mind, that's how you do that. But then the story didn't have any stakes to it whatsoever until finally someone said, oh, there's a space station and a planet that way, and if the Klingons went after it, that would be bad. And it's like, compare that to the original series pilot that sold, where no man has gone before. There's immediate urgency.
As opposed to the first that was broadcast.
Yes, there's almost immediate urgency and an alarm going off by the end of the teaser, and stakes that develop quickly and get worse and worse and worse as it goes on.
That happened in Discovery, too. Oh, I mean, I don't disagree that there were issues with the pilot, but there were stakes. There was a war broke out.
Yes, but not in the teaser.
Okay.
What I found weird, and here again I'm going only on the first episode that was broadcast.
Which is what John is calling the teaser.
I'm calling the first 5 minutes before the credits.
Oh, yeah, well...
That's the tease.
And that's the tease.
Okay.
And basically by halfway through the episode, we have our heroine in a spacesuit going out to explore a big alien structure.
Okay, let me say something about the tease.
Yeah.
It sucked.
It was awful.
It really was. It was awful. First of all, the acting. I had two decent actors. I like Michelle Yeoh. I've seen her in a number of things, and I've not seen The Walking Dead, but I like the actress.
I've seen Sinequa Martin-Green in other things, including a short-lived police procedural called NYC 22, and she was an episode of Law and Order Criminal Intent back about 8-9 years ago.
Okay,
so and she was excellent.
Okay, so as I said, two good actors, wooden. They were both wooden. One because brought up by Vulcans, the other because, I don't know.
I didn't feel they were wooden at all. I thought the dialogue was clunky, although
that's why they were wooden.
I thought they managed to transcend it.
I just need to throw in that the drawing a giant Starfleet emblem in the sand in order to attract attention was lifted from a Star Trek comic book written by my ex-boss, Kevin Ryan.
Oh, okay. But
or was first used. Let's say first used.
Yeah,
I thought that was cool.
And it was cool.
And partly because I remembered that comic book, too.
And you know why
I own that comic book, so therefore...
Yeah.
And you know why I thought it wasn't cool? Because I didn't get it. I was watching and I didn't happen to notice. I got we're walking in circles. No, not exactly a circle. I left a sign. Camera pans out, and on my 40-inch screen, it wasn't until I saw a screenshot later that I realized, oh, there's the insignia.
I got it right away.
But neither Barbara or I... Huh. No, actually, no. Barbara did get it, but I didn't. And a lot of people that I've... discussed it with on social media, didn't know until the photo was posted and say, see, and they're going, oh, I didn't catch that.
A lot of people tend to watch TV with their ears. They tend to listen to it more than they watch it. They're looking at something else. They're doing something else.
Yes.
And for those people,
It's a passive medium.
Both Klingon.
I was watching. There were points I was wishing I was looking away, but I was watching.
Right. But but I was listening with my ears, which I really do,
right,
of radio background, and I found the two characters who should be who are very good actors, yeah, speaking in. It was just terrible. It came off as if for whatever reason, it came off as bad acting. And I am one of many people to say this. So whether you agree or not, there's two sides to that.
Dan, let me ask you a question. When I saw the Klingons speaking in Klingon during all those scenes, I could have...
We're getting way ahead.
Yes. Well, no, that's
no. That was the first. The first scene.
Yeah, that was the first. Scene. Oh, okay.
The very first.
Sorry.
Scene.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I saw them speaking in Klingon. That was fine, but I began to realize that it seemed like the actors were opening and closing their mouths, and the dialogue was looped in later in Klingon, by somebody else.
Often happens, and I know this happened with the scene on Vulcan in Star Trek: The Motion Picture. Is they're speaking English on stage, and then they loop in.
That was I understand that, but to me it started to look like an animated cartoon where the mouths just sort of randomly open and close, and the actors weren't able to emote for some reason. Now that when the same actors were speaking English later on, when talking directly to
Giorgio,
To Giorgio, they were fine. They were really good. So what? Something was going on.
The biggest problem there, and I mentioned this in my review, Chris Obi is the actor who played T'Kuvma, the head Klingon. And he, among other things, he's also playing Anubis.
He's the blue
No. Okay. He's the one playing Anubis on American Gods as well.
Oh, okay.
Same actor. But, the Klingon makeup generally has always been death on facial expressions, which is why they tend to gravitate toward people with cool voices to play Klingons. You know, guys like J.J. Hertzler and Michael Dorn and John Vickery and guys like that. And Christopher Plummer, for that matter. Christopher Lloyd. I thought that having him... the makeup, this was even more extensive in the new redesign than it has been in the past. Between that and having him speaking in Klingon the entire time, I think was a major misstep. I think opening it with him in Klingon, starting with that, and then switching to English would have been a better move.
Yeah.
Simply because...
Like the way they did in Hunt for Red October.
Right, exactly. They
also did that in one of the Star Trek films. I think it was Star Trek V, wasn't it? No, Star Trek VI.
It was in VI they were speaking Klingon occasionally, but mostly they just kept it in English with just a few bits and pieces.
The sixth one with Christopher Plummer?
Plummer, yes. Yeah. But I part of what I did for the 50th anniversary of Star Trek was review some ancillary stuff, and I watched, God help me, Incubus, the movie, which was a movie William Shatner starred in, also in 1966, which was filmed entirely in Esperanto.
Yeah.
And the biggest problem with that movie was that every single actor was too busy trying to wrap their tongue around a language that doesn't actually exist in order to... they were too busy focusing on that, and they couldn't focus as much on the acting. Shatner actually did a better job than most of the people in the movie, but even he, every once in a while, was very obviously trying too hard to speak the words rather than actually be the character. And I had that problem with most of the Klingons in Discovery, and there were so many of them.
The part that I had with it was I could either watch them or read. So I couldn't even tell if they were remoting. If I was reading, it was on the bottom of the screen.
Yeah.
That was my problem, too. I mean, what's better than an extended dialogue scene? It's an extended dialogue scene in a language that doesn't exist so that you're reading subtitles instead of looking at what's going on.
And that can work in limited doses, but there was just too much of it.
No, there was way too much of it.
Yeah.
How many times? What was the phrase "light the torch"?
Yeah.
Was that the phrase
light
they
the
used?
Beacon.
How many
light
times did they use that phrase?
More than was necessary.
Well, I mean, but I mean, take a look at a political rally today, which is what they
but
were
the thing
doing.
Is, that would have been more effective if they had done it in a language that, if you're not reading the subtitles, but you hear them actually speaking it instead.
I agree. What about the look of the show?
I liked the look of the show.
Didn't I?
I didn't have a problem with the changing technology simply because
it's not 1967.
Yeah. I think actually it was Dave Mack who said the reason it doesn't look like, you know, it doesn't look like the Cage or Where No Man Has Gone Before is because in 2017 you really can't do a science fiction show that looks like it was produced in a high school basement.
But that's not the point.
Yeah, but
you can take that and bring it in with modern technology and all that instead of taking a look at something that is all CGI instead of practical special effects.
That,
when you watch the J.J. Abrams movies that Alex Kurtzman, same producer, worked on, those are, A, better CGI effects. They have more money. And B, more importantly, there are way more practical effects. They're using sets instead of they're using drawings instead of just let's do a virtual planet. And the glossy look, the sheen that the show has, and the bizarre camera angles, which Dan pointed out in his review, that has nothing to do with looking like pre-1967. That is plain and simple bad CGI work.
But the bottom line for me is, if the story had worked, I wouldn't have given a damn. It could have been hand drawings by a 12-year-old if there was a good story.
I meant 12-year-olds
can
draw. The thing is that what I'm detecting here, and I had mentioned Lost in Space in my review, and granted, you know, I checked the IMDb listings, and there are something like 28 some odd producers of various capacities.
Well, 12
on this, but I am detecting the hand of Akiva Goldsman in this. Like Lost in Space, there's a lot of it ain't broke, but let's fix it anyway. In this, and so you know, the bridge gets swaddled in blackness. There is the vertiginous camera moves, which are absolutely not necessary. As far as I'm concerned, if you're going to be doing vertiginous camera moves, the only one who should be doing that is Alfred Hitchcock in Vertigo.
And he's dead, I think.
Yeah, that's true. So
that's what they want you to believe.
Yeah, I was going to say. I mean, this is Hitchcock's longest fake out so far.
Yeah. But there actually is a shot in Discovery where the camera rotates a full 360 around two characters in the dialogue scene for absolutely no reason. When Hitchcock did it in Vertigo, there was a definite reason. There was a textual reason for the camera to make that move. Here, it's just to show off.
Well, yes, I would agree with that. But again, where I'm coming from, if it had told a compelling story...
Bring the mic down. Don't move the mic. Just the... Here, let me do it. That's better. Yes.
Okay. For me, again, if the story had worked, for almost at least the first two-thirds of the first hour... the only thing at risk at all is the life of the starring character.
And no, there was a risk of war. You keep saying there's no stakes when there's an interstellar war brewing. And I'm sorry, that's stakes.
Yes, but at what point did we realize it was even a Klingon installation?
Pretty early on, when she met the Klingon on the thing and killed him.
That takes place after the halfway mark in the first episode.
It does. Did it?
Yes, yeah. it was more than 15 minutes in.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess I'm more patient than
you. But if you think of it as a two-hour, not counting commercials, so call it an hour, 35-minute story, which is what it would run, I think, approximately without commercials.
Roughly.
Then it works if you show them together, if you watch them together. For me, that was the biggest problem, that they made this bad decision to take the pilot and split it into two parts.
I think in general...
On two platforms.
Yeah, I think in general the intentions of the writing staff were undermined by production decisions like that. Unfortunately, I think,
and not even necessarily production decisions, but network decisions.
That's what I meant.
Yeah.
decisions that were made independently of the actual writing and directing and producing of the episodes, which is being done by people who don't make those decisions, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
I really think this was designed to be watched in the manner in which a lot of people, I mean, Dan mentioned it, and it's one that I've heard commonly, is that people are going to wait until there's a significant number of episodes out, get the free week, and then watch a whole bunch of it at once, if not the whole first season.
That's what I'll be doing.
Yeah.
It's what I did with American Gods.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, no, that did they all come out at the same time?
No.
On Starz?
That was released weekly.
Oh, okay.
That was released weekly. But, and I think, I'm suspecting...
The place where Fuller went, yes.
They're telling a specific story arc. This is designed as a 15-episode story, of which these two episodes are really just the prelude, complete with fake-out of you know, two people who you think might be the main character, the main protagonist and antagonist.
Well,
before the hour is over.
You know, I knew that during the opening credits of the first episode.
Because she was listed as a special guest star.
Yes. Yeah, that's it. That's it.
It was Chris Obey that it was Takuvma's death that surprised me, because he was being set up as the big bad.
Nah.
And so that was a nicely done little fake out. I also like the fact, and this was something Dan didn't get to see by not watching the second hour. I liked the fact that for once in a Star Trek series, finally, somebody breaks the rules and actually gets called on it and gets punished. Because the characters in Star Trek break the rules.
Are you saying Spock commandeering the Enterprise and faking Captain Kirk's orders to get Captain Pike, get Captain Pike to the Talosians was somehow a violation of Starfleet orders?
Yeah, like the part where he assaulted two officers.
I agree with you on that, but the problem I have with it is her jump. She's been working with this captain for 7 years, and her jump is to save her captain. Save the captain's life, and it's like that didn't. You're an exec officer.
I found it.
Perhaps Dave Mack will address his novel.
Novel. What's it called? Let's stop with that and let's stick to Dan. You were saying.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That was a big problem for me as well. I mean, you don't get to be number one. They don't hand number one slots out of cereal boxes. You get to be number one because you're one step away from being captain. You have the judgment, you have the temperament, you have the intelligence to be captain. And what Burnham did at the end of episode one, no well-trained officer would do that.
Except well-trained officers on Star Trek have
saving the captain's life.
Keith does have a point there. That this is what Trek officers have always done.
And in this case, there are actually consequences for it. The second episode ends with her being put in jail after being court-martialed and pleading guilty.
And that, by the way, to me, is a very exciting thing. The idea that our protagonist is coming in as somebody who has the bad rep in Starfleet, who's going to be viewed as the dark figure. It's like a lot of the better militaristic science fiction that one might find from, say, Bane books or even Jerry Pornell or David Weber or one of those style writers.
Of course, that's how Peter David and I set up Star Trek New Frontier.
Yeah.
To have a
but that's a book.
Yes, yeah. And I'm aware that's a book.
Okay, so, and it's a good point. But just separate from my point is that for me, the idea of, oh boy, our lead character is not only in the outs, but it's not going to be resolved within 5 minutes of the next episode. It's going to be a major part of the remaining 13 episodes.
Yeah, it's obvious. Sorry.
I'm wondering whether or not she's going to be the only one, because part of my brain is going, is Isaac's playing a Leave Marvin or not on this one? I don't know yet, because I haven't read ahead or know anybody who's going to tell. Well, I know people who, but they're not allowed to tell me. But I looked at this going, we know he's going to be not – he's already stated in interviews he is not the goody two-shoes. He's got his own issues. And I'm wondering, are we going to see a Dirty Dozen here? See,
this is why this two-parter should have been episode 5 and episode 6.
Mm-hmm. Should have been flashbacks?
But they always get episode numbers. I mean, with original Trek, episode 6 was the first one broadcast.
That's not what I mean. In the order in which it's broadcast, they should have started on the Discovery, introduced that whole setup, hinted at her background, and then hit us with this in episodes 5 and 6, which is what the Netflix Marvel movies do.
Not always to good effect, but yes. I agree. That might have worked better. Although I'm frustrated by the fact that, I mean, I knew, you know, because she was listed as a special guest star, that Georgiou probably wasn't long for this world.
Yeah.
But despite the issues that both Jim and John have brought up here, I was utterly captivated by the relationship between Georgiou and Burnham.
Yes.
I was, the interactions between the two of them, both in the present and in the flashback to when she first came on board. From what I understand, there will be more flashbacks with Georgiou.
I was going to say, I would be shocked.
Yeah.
I would be shocked if they don't have
more. I have it on good authority that we will be seeing more of Georgiou in flashback.
And Sarek in flashback.
Well, and in the foreground. Present. And for what it's worth, I think the casting of James Frayne was excellent there.
Yes.
It's certainly a hell of a lot better than Ben Cross.
The only issue I have is his slight smirk. Sometimes it reminds me of him in other parts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He always smirks, though. Mark Leonard smirked too.
That would be a great name for a pub, the Smirking Vulcan.
By the way, does Sarek just hang by the holographic communication unit all day?
Yeah.
Probably. He picked up the phone rather fast.
They set it up that he put part of his Katra in.
That was the second part. In the first part, it was a straight up communication.
The first one, he was right there.
When we're talking about technological problems and sort of going retro future on this whole thing, forgetting about the look and the CGI and the special effects, the one thing that has everybody scratching their heads over is the hologram.
Not everybody. It doesn't bother me.
It doesn't bother me at all. The holocommunicator was in Deep Space Nine.
It only bothers me when it's dealing with the Admiral literally stumbling across in hologram form across the stage. That was not necessary.
No.
Yeah, and it's appearing on top of a desk. And if this technology existed 10 years before TOS, why didn't we see it until DS9? And they didn't use it to that effect in DS9.
Because they didn't have the money for it.
Well, that's the answer.
And my answer actually comes from Gene Roddenberry.
Yes.
Who said in 1979, when people asked him, why do the Klingons look different now? He said, the Klingons always look like that. We just couldn't afford to show them looking like that.
Well, yes.
Because of the budgets we had.
Absolutely.
And that applies to the technology.
And by the way, I did read in an interview going way back when they were first discussing this series that this show will somehow explain where the Worf-like Klingon comes from.
Yeah, they'd already done that, but yeah.
I never watched more than three episodes.
Klingons came from.
Yeah,
See, what I was thinking, it would. Since I said,
no, they're going to be doing something different than they did in Enterprise.
What I was thinking was
because they talked about it a lot in interviews, and if somebody had said, "Oh, they did that in Enterprise," they wouldn't have talked a lot about Discovery.
If you're going to have that many different Klingon tribes all being pulled together in the same space, then why not have, and it could be connected to the virus just fine, why not have the assembled tribes of Klingons, some of them look like TOS Klingons, some of them look like Mark Leonard from TMP Klingons, some of them look like General Chang. In other words, explain it without saying a word by just having, if you're going to pull in all these different tribes who've been split apart, bring them back together and show that there's a variety of Klingon racial structure.
And I like that.
That would have been cool.
Yeah. Yes. And they may still go there. Yeah.
Although the ones we saw were all looked like.
Yeah, but just the 24 on the council, and there's many more families than that.
Oh, that's right.
They're the only ones
on the
council. Frickin' interstellar empires.
So I think it's time for us to take a break.
Okay.
And if everybody on Skype and in studio stand by for gaining more water or whatever, there are a couple of things that must attention must be paid, said the salesman, to something. Oh, I see. God, I swear, the equipment in this space. Well, maybe I've got it to get. Oh, no, 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 no. I still have it on my thumb drive. So I have to switch over for a moment. Pardon me, folks at home. But I will tell you, while I'm doing that, that you're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming over WBAI.org. This program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. We are discussing Star Trek Discovery. With us are Dan Persons, John Ordover, Keith R.A. DeCandido, and in final place this time, because she got top billing before, Ren Sims. And we will be back very shortly.
Spaced. The final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Booby Prize. Its five-year mission? To sell t-shirts, toy phasers, plastic communicators, and anything else we can think of. To seek out new life in old plots and complications. To boldly go where everyone has gone before.
Star Trek.
Captain's log, stardate 6935.2. We are in orbit around the planet Schwartz.
Engineering to Captain Jerk. Engineering to Captain Jerk.
Jerk here. What is it, Snotty?
Captain, the warp drive engines are generating excess antimatter. The pods are overloading now. If it continues at this rate, how can it be responsible for the safety of the ship?
I want answers, mister.
Well, I tried shoving a wiener in the warp drive, but it didn't do a bit of good. By the by, would you have a wee bit of mustard up on the bridge?
Mr. Schlock?
No mustard, Captain.
Analysis, Schlock?
It would appear that Lieutenant Snot is about to eat wiener without mustard.
As always, your logic is impeccable, Mr. Schlock. Dr. McGoy?
I'm a doctor, not a scriptwriter!
Sensors, Mr. Schlock?
Computer data coming in now. It's exactly what we need, Jim. A colossal negative space turkey of infinite power coming right at us at warp factor 11.
Commence evasive action, Mr. Lulu?
Yes, Captain Jack.
Evasive action's ineffective, Captain. The turkey is turning with us and closing rapidly.
Estimated time of impact?
Approximately 16.24 seconds, Captain. Then again, I could be a little off.
Readings, Mr. Schlock.
Off the scale, Captain. I have not encountered this phenomenon before.
Damage report, Lieutenant Minora.
Honey, I'd say we've taken a shellacking out here.
Bridge to engineering.
Snot here, Captain.
What's not there, Snotty?
I said Snot here, Captain.
Snotty, give me full power. Get us out of here fast.
Oh, I cannot do it. The toilets are bunked up into the warp drive mechanism. It'll take time to make repairs.
Fascinating.
What, Mr. Schlock?
The program's almost over, and you haven't yet found an alien to fall in love with.
Recommendation?
I'd suggest we beam down to the planet's surface and hang out, Captain.
Logical, Mr. Schlock. Perfectly logical. Mr. Lulu, you've got the con.
Thank you, Captain Jack.
Into the elevator, Mr. Schlock. Elevator, transporter room.
I'm fine. How are you?
Elevator, I said transporter room.
I'm fine. How are you?
No, forget it. Fine. Elevator to engineering. Beam us down from here, Snotty.
Aye, aye, Captain. You're locked on coordinates now.
Energize, Mr. Snot.
Remarkable.
What do you make of it, Mr. Schlock?
There is no record of any such civilization as this on the planet Schwartz, Capitan.
Look, Schlock, here comes a car, and feast your Vulcan squinties on that driver.
Far out, Captain Jerk.
Looks like the Starfleet's in. Want a lift, sailor?
As a matter of fact, I do. Well, I'll say goodbye here, Schlock. Now you'll have what you've always wanted, command of the Booby Prize.
And you'll have what you always wanted, Jimbo.
And what is that, Mr. Schlock?
A bleach blonde in red convertible on planet Schwartz.
Right on, Schlock. Say bye-bye to Starfleet Command for me, and I'll see you on Hollywood Squares.
Bye-bye, Jim.
Say, Space Fox, what's your sign?
Oh, dangerous curves, big
I thought he'd never leave. Schlock to booby prize.
Snot here, Mr. Schlock.
What's not there, Lieutenant Snot?
I said snot here, Mr. Schlock.
That's Captain Schlock.
Aye?
And make it one to beam up.
Star Trek, the remake. Bobby Pickett, or as he is usually known in October, Bobby Boris Pickett, for his very famous, of course, Monster Mash and the various follow-ups that he did to that. And he did Star Trek at WBAI through Peter Zanger and Frank Heller. And I don't have that version right now. Frank, if you're listening from the West Coast, let me know if I have it. Frank sent me this wonderful 7-disc set of his music. And I'm wondering if the original Star Trek is among his collections. I would like to get a hold of that because it's better than the single that came out. Although I did like the flip side, the B-side of the single, King Kong, Your Song, which also would have been... By the way, I liked Skull Island. And we have to get Dan back up. You liked Skull Island too, right?
Yeah, I really did. You know, it's a dumb movie. It's like the epitome
of
commercial filmmaking now. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's like, you know, you pays your money, you has a good time, you buy some popcorn, you leave, you smile.
Yeah, the basic idea is you don't go to a Harryhausen film for the story.
Well, see, I have a completely different opinion. I saw that movie, and I thought, wow, finally something to rival Shakespeare.
There you go.
I don't believe you really said that.
Yeah, no, I didn't. No, it's only when you realize that the skull was Yorick.
Yes.
That you start recognizing.
You can't appreciate King Kong until you see it in the original Klingon.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, once again, reintroducing, this is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI.
Is that what this is?
And sometimes, actually, Hour of the Wolf is the morning twilight, but we retain the title after...
How many thousands of years?
Well, we're in our 46th year
okay.
with this show, to be precise. So, yow, with me at the helm, right. 43rd year, I believe. Margot Adler started the show in 72. But for those who want to hear my exhaustive history, I do it on this show every week anyway. Next Monday, 3 p.m. over these airwaves, I'll with Janet Coleman and Jim Irsay, I think the three of us together... bring us to just about 150 years. Seriously. Because Janet predates me and Irsay is a newbie. He started about 3 years after I did. And he came in like 1971. So he's a newbie.
I have a question about WBAI history for you, Jim.
Yeah.
In all the time you've been here, has there ever been a better name that any staff person had than Fettigan Boich?
Fettigan Boich.
With an F or a TH?
Yeah, I don't know the provenance of that name, other than it was on Poisoned Art, so that's really a question that has to be put forth to Janet Coleman. Okay. But as far as staff members of WBAI are concerned, the aforementioned Frank Heller was... the janitor, but his title was, he was the Svensson, you know, so if something needs cleaning up, you call the Svensson over, and Svensson will clean it up for you.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. So, we have been mostly discussing Discovery, and I guess we'll continue to do so. So much is unknown, but this has been such a big deal in coming. Enterprise certainly didn't have that. Maybe the J.J. Abrams film did.
Well, it's interesting, looking at the history of Star Trek, is that, to my mind, at least, the science fiction blockbuster movie model has never been a good fit for Star Trek. It's never been
If you take any list of the 10 or 15 or 20 best Star Trek stories ever produced on screen, I don't think any of the movies would make the cut. Ever.
Two.
Not even that one.
I like two and four. Four because it was a comedy.
Keith is wrong about two and four. You just have to get that on the table right now.
Well, I'm not. But but still, when you think of the best of Star Trek, you think of The City on the Edge of Forever. You think of The Visitor. You think of Yesterday's Enterprise. You think of The Best of Both Worlds. You think of Jatrell. You think of Judgment. You think of episodes of the show. That's where Star Trek has always thrived. And yet, it has been the movies that have basically gotten it back into the public consciousness after it had fallen away. It was Star Trek the Motion Picture that got Star Trek going again as a franchise, not just...
No, it didn't.
No, it did. It absolutely did. It was a terrible movie, but it's what got the public interested in Star Trek, in new Star Trek again. It's what led to there being new comic books, there being new...
There were new comic books, there were new toys and stuff like that.
Yes.
But they had killed production on the idea of any other film, even though they had Robert Wise doing that first one until Nicholas Meyer, who was somehow...
That was only a couple of years later, though. It was still...
I think it's longer than that.
No, it wasn't. It was only a couple of years later. It was 1979 was the motion picture, 1982 was Wrath of Khan.
Release. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things over the years people always ask me, you know, there's always been these Star Wars, Star Trek fight, which has, you know, been nonsensical and over-emotional.
And pointless.
Yeah. But what I've said when people have asked me about that, I said, look, George Lucas pointed to Star Trek conventions and said, that's why there'll be a market greenlight my Star Wars movie. Then Star Wars came out. And that's why Paramount said, let's not do this as a TV show. Let's do Star Trek the Motion Picture as a movie.
Actually, it was the other way around. It was because of Star Wars that they decided to do it as a TV show.
Right.
But then they wound up deciding to kill the network because of the
Ewok adventures.
Yeah. But they killed the network. And, well, we've already devoted the money to this. Let's make a movie because Star Wars worked as a movie, too. Right. So, yeah. But they did feed off each other.
Yes. Yeah. And then Next Generation only happened because... But basically, none of the two series are so interdependent that setting them up as enemies, as opposed to just enjoying them both, which it's certainly possible to do, was always a mistake.
Yeah, but history basically repeated itself because it was the success of the first three movies that led to Next Generation being greenlit as a TV show, which led to there being a renaissance of Star Trek on TV throughout the late 80s and early 90s. And then we come around to the turn of the millennium when we have Star Trek Enterprise, which was the first Star Trek spinoff to fail in the marketplace.
Deservedly.
And then there was no Star Trek for 4 years.
And I love Scott Bakula, by the way.
I love Scott Bakula in almost everything he's done, the exception being
Enterprise.
Well, he's not that great in NCIS New Orleans.
You still like him there where I don't, but... NCIS.
Well, I like the show. I just don't like him.
What kills it is the New Orleans accent he's forced without.
He's not doing that anymore.
Let me say this about Enterprise is that, as opposed to Discovery, as far as the technology is concerned, you could better draw a line from Enterprise to the original series.
Wow, I don't agree with that.
As far as technology, than you can Discovery.
Actually, I do agree with that.
Series. I don't.
I don't
think Enterprise is any better at it. Well, then to quote
people in here, you're wrong.
What makes it fun is all the different opinions.
It's the look of the thing. I think Discovery would be much easier to take, especially that part that didn't work, where when all is said and done, I thought it worked. When you've watched the whole thing and you take it as a single, I thought it worked. But, you know, piece by piece, what was broadcast versus what you had to obtain through credit card is another issue altogether. But it's a similar situation to what's happened with
films adapted from YA books where they split it into two different films.
Okay, that's not where I was going. Where I was going is that I think Discovery would have worked far, far better if it were set in a further future, not just 10 years before Enterprise.
I agree with that, absolutely.
Definitely.
Yeah, I'm not sure why prequels are being done.
Well, that was Brian Fuller's thing, by the way. He was the one who wanted it to be pre-TOS.
That yeah, well, maybe he had a vision that then, you know, won't come through.
I don't see there's anything inherently wrong with wanting to show our first interaction with the Klingons. First face-to-face interaction with Klingons.
But it's not working on this show.
It's not working on this show. Why they don't jump Star Trek ahead another 50 years TNG,
yes.
I do not understand. Yes. There's some yes. sort of...
like which the future, department owns the future it ends on. There.
Yeah.
There's a curtain that they
there
can't
is absolutely
jump
no reason why they couldn't have done that from a story perspective anyway. And this story still could work if you jump it ahead sufficiently far
absolutely.
In the timeline. There was some sort of conflict between the Federation and the Klingons that has led to there being no contact or very little contact for a while. The Alliance has gone fallow for whatever reason.
And it also
you know.
Doesn't have to be Klingons. It could be the Shmoygans with Klingons
and for
as
that
part
matter,
of the Federation.
It doesn't have to be Star Trek, except for the fact that Paramount owns the name Star Trek.
No, it does. It does. Because you whatever else you have, Dan, you do have a structure that is the Federation, that is the idea of Roddenberry's original vision. This will end up with the optimistic universe.
There was a line that was in one of the trailers from Jason Isaacs' character, which really actually was one of the things that gave me hope for the show, was, and the line actually makes more sense now that the first two episodes have aired, where Isaacs' character says to Burnham, "You started this war, help me end it."
Yeah.
And that to my mind, that seems to me to mean what the rest of the show is going to be about, which is very much
and
a Star Trek
thing. This, I mean, I think what Brian Fuller may have had in mind would be to take Discovery and end its first season in the same way that Rogue One was the immediate prequel to Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only one movie that's ever been called Star Wars, and that's how I refer to it.
Good.
And maybe that was the idea. Mm-hmm. But Fuller left the series fairly... The series was then postponed, twice?
Yeah.
So that the date on which it finally came out was its third broadcast date, and some said they were a little premature, but it was launch TV series season, so they were going to do it in September because that's traditional. Mm. Although,
yeah, I'm not sure that was such a wise idea as well, because once again, they are counting on people buying into CBS All Access. Meanwhile,
but right now we're talking
about
story.
But my DVR, DVR is backed up with the debuts of the new series. I've got other stuff to watch.
By the way, another reason why I think it need, you know, what you mentioned before about how it whether it needs to be Star Trek or not. Star Trek already has the structure there. One of the many things that bugs me about the Orville is that it's not even trying really hard to file the serial numbers off. The Union is the Federation. It's got the only thing missing is transporter technology, and that was a conscious choice. Everything else is exactly the same structure.
It
would be as if the opening credits of the Orville didn't completely rip off the opening credits of Voyager.
Well, I haven't watched the Orville.
Ren? The other thing about the Orville is that the second episode totally lost me, because their first response when they can't see any human life forms should be that their captain and XO are dead, because they don't have transporter technology. They don't. But their whole direction is, let's get them back. But if they're not there, then why is it not their first response?
By the way,
it's
speaking
not.
Of design
so
that I thought was brilliant.
They're not really filing off transporter technology.
Yeah.
One of the things I thought was brilliant in Discovery, which again you see more in part two than in part one, is showing the rudimentary transporter with those discs instead of the...
The side transporter instead of
the side
on the bottom.
Transporter.
Yeah, that was cute.
I thought that it was knowing something about gadget and technology design and how something moves from point A to point B in the universe of design stuff. It made perfect sense.
Yeah. I also really liked the communicator, which was very much like the Cage communicators, except bigger and clunkier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the phasers were very nicely done, too.
Yeah, it looked like halfway between the cape.
Let me jump back to what you're saying. It doesn't have to be Star Trek.
In terms of Space Wars, the phasers versus they had very few photon torpedoes. So that worked as well.
The one of the things Keith said about not having to be Star Trek, the bottom line is the whole of Hollywood, for a very long time, has acted as if that Star Trek owns all of space opera on TV. And if nothing else, the Orville is showing it doesn't.
No, I think I don't believe that. People accepted Galactica. I don't know why, but they did. And
and Stargate, for that matter.
And Stargate.
And there are a number of new ones, like Expanse.
I'm specifically talking about a ship in or near a galactic League of Nations with a mixed human and alien crew that goes around solving problems.
I mean Lensman.
That's exactly what I mean. Lensman. I've said this on the show before.
Yeah.
Why someone doesn't make a TV show out of Lensman?
It probably because it would be so derivative.
Yeah.
Same reason why nobody reacted well to John Carter of Mars.
Officers who use the Force.
I have knowledge about that that I cannot speak.
Right.
But it's not television. It's a movie franchise.
Right.
Mentioning Stargate, that just opened another wound with all these things. The Stargate Channel. This is really happening. And it's got, initially, they've announced it for, are you ready? $20 a month.
How do you do a prequel of a case where you've only had one failed use of the Stargate? Only one. What are they going to do? Suddenly realize they did a whole lot more than that? Her husband disappeared.
That's
not what they're doing.
No, God, they're starting with her as a child.
Okay, you're popping your peas. Don't talk directly into the microphone. But the answer to that is, A, there's a new series that's in production right now. B, they have, five other series, including some awful animated series?
There's four altogether. Counting the animated series, there's four.
The series is a prequel, though.
Don't care.
Okay.
They're talking the Stargate universe, and they're starting with a new thing in that franchise. Why? I don't know. Because Stargate universe, oh my God. There have been some really bizarre myths. But the point is, one show with its... $20 a month? Yeah, that's really... Even if it were $2 a month, I think that would be asking a bit too much. People aren't going to pay it.
Maybe not. They're not going to find out until they try. That's how capitalism works.
Well, here's bad news. They're trying it.
Yeah.
I think it's too much. I mean, I've got no problem with $5.99 a month because, you know, that's what? One trip to Starbucks. I don't need to go to.
Somebody, Greg Cox pointed out on Facebook, somebody said to him, you know, Greg, I love your novels, but I'm not going to pay for Star Trek. To which Greg's response was, did you steal my novels?
Yeah.
Well, I got a review copy, but all that aside, the answer to that is, first of all, a novel lasts you for a good long time.
No, I know.
And it's a different medium. It's not a quid pro quo comparison. Keith and Jim,
you're both reminding me of something that when we started to accelerate the Star Trek program from 6 books a year to 12 books a year to 24 books a year to 50 books a year, I said, aren't we really over-publishing Star Trek at this point? This is ridiculous. And my boss said to me, well, John, you may be right, you may be wrong, but I can tell you this much. We're going to find out.
Well, also for...
And for a while you did, and then in 2005 they cut back because... There was a saturation point.
For $5.99 a month, that's what, 4 hours? Between three and four hours worth of TV. I can read a Star Trek novel in 3 to 4 hours.
Yeah.
So.
It depends on how much it would have been worth. If I had been more impressed with this first episode, I was fully inclined to sign up. For CBS All Access.
And that's always the risk.
The way it's gone, I saw the Orville and I saw the pilot and I said, well, this isn't good. But I got something off of it that said, well, let me stick with it and see where it's going. And
that's because it's available freely.
Yeah.
Well, that's it's sort of cheap. Even not freely. It's part of your cable package, you know. But you are paying
what
anyway.
Channel is it on?
For us?
It's on Fox. You can get on Broadcast.
It's on Fox.
Get Broadcast. So,
okay,
no.
But you can.
Yes.
But you can is the
put
point.
Up an antenna.
It is broadcast freely.
Yes,
it is.
Well, not freely. There are commercials. But.
Well, no. You obtain it for free.
Yes.
They get paid for sending you commercials. You are obtaining the product for free. Yes. And that is the model for which people know Star Trek. Now, if you want to put it onto a cable channel, that's one thing. If you want to put it onto something else, but to take a free channel, CBS, a free channel, and to say, you know, we're worried about the network model because of Netflix and its competitors and HBO, and look at all the money that they're raking in. So we're going to do that on our own. So now you have that, you have FX, you have Stargate, for God's sake, one based on a show. You know, I would have less problem paying for something per episode than I were for, you know, when I get a cable package, you know what I object to? Why am I paying for ESPN? I will never, ever in my life watch Tiddlywinks or NASCAR on TV. There are people who like
the
NASCAR.
Big Tiddlywinks versus NASCAR crossover.
Well, I, yeah,
that you would want to
well, playing Tiddlywinks in the middle of the road. Yeah. Yes, but that
a cricket tournament.
Bad.
A cricket tournament. I have had Englishmen try to explain to me how cricket works.
Yeah, but that's
works.
Not. But to finish what no, I was saying, no. When you have a cable package, and that cable package comes through, you know, you want ABC. You want ABC? Oh, that's owned by Disney.
Disney get ESPN whether you want it or not.
Yeah, yes. So Disney is going to sell to the carrier, ESPN, and they have no choice in that matter. And there were. Have been blackouts and showdowns and all and that. ABC went off the air for some hours because of ESPN. And what does the carrier do? They charge me. Mm-hmm. Now, I am never, ever in my life going to want to watch ESPN. Well, at this point, want to watch anything on ESPN. And there are so many channels that I am paying for that I don't want. And when you talk about CBS All Access, there are so many shows on CBS that I have no interest in. I don't want them. Now, if you said, okay, next episode of Discovery, $1.50, I might lay it out. Might even lay out a different price and all that. You know, so that
with going the a la carte route is that while you're getting the package, you're getting the ESPN that you're not watching with ABC, there are also other channels such as, oh boy.
It's like insurance, yeah, we're now subsidizing each other's channels.
AMC,
yeah.
For example, that might starve to death if people were allowed to pick and choose which channels they are going to be paying for.
Well, considering, you know, AMC with the Real Housewives of this place and that, which doesn't have anything much that they have a limited amount of stuff that's American. They have no movies and they're barely a channel. Why are they called American Movie Channel?
I picked the wrong channel. I should have said something on the order of IFC or Sunday.
Oh, TCM. I live for TCM.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, but AMC has The Walking Dead
and PS,
Better Call Saul and a bunch of other things that are among the most successful shows on television. So AMC is a real channel.
Yeah, I
understand. Yeah. I'm talking about things like IFC, Sundance.
Oh, as my boss said, Jim, I'll quote him because he's
absolutely
right.
IFC and Sundance have both failed.
CBS All Access may be a really awful idea, like you say. You may be right about that. You may be wrong. But I can tell you this much. We're going to find out.
Well, you know, again, I don't give a bleep for a very simple reason. I am not your boss. I don't work for Star Trek. I don't work for CBS. I'm a freaking consumer. And as a consumer, I'm saying, not paying for this. And you know what? The majority of people that I see in social media who can be a certain number of bellwether types, leading other people to which way or what they're going to go that way as well. This is why so many people, resort to piracy, to download illegal downloads and stuff like that, because the alternative is onerous to them. It has been shown, and in fact, there was a recent published study, actually, no, published some time ago and somewhat suppressed, that came out of England, that stated that piracy actually isn't harming TV and product that much, and it really only occurs in places where consumers feel price gouged.
Jim, if someone had come to me 9 years ago and said to me, would you be willing to spend $22 to see a movie just because the screen is larger and it's in 3D? I would have thought they were crazy.
And you know what? I still don't.
Yes, but I do. As it turned out, I was wrong.
You were wrong, and all I can say is there is a theater 5 blocks from here that charges half of that and does a far, far better job and is probably the best movie theater in New York City.
Jim, for an adult, if you never saw Gravity in the Lincoln Square IMAX theater.
You're wrong, I did.
Okay, so there you go. So okay. I mean,
there are certain things you will see that way then.
Well, I got in for free.
Okay.
B.
Oh, well.
Oh, yeah, you know, hit radio show.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
well, B.
Oh, you have one of those?
Yeah.
Is it anything like this?
I would say there are 4 to 5 movies that are worth the 3D experience, and not more than that.
Well, yeah. we don't usually do. I don't
Hugo
like
is one.
I usually don't like 3D because it gives me headaches. But I'm willing to pay $14 to see it in a comfy chair that reclines.
Yes, yeah. Yes. You know? But I have news for you. Again, as I said, there's a theater in this very neighborhood that charges $11.
So, yeah, but then I have to get to Brooklyn.
And they have come. Yeah. Well, actually,
one near you too. We'll talk later.
Okay.
but the bottom line is, you could be absolutely right. We will see what happens.
And you know, we'll
see what happens.
We're not going to know when. You know, it's going to be months.
Well, we're not going to know what they are going to do. There were certainly people that predicted the failure of Netflix the moment they went to streaming from sending out discs, and there were people who were saying, you know, how are they going to come up against Blockbuster? This isn't going to work.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Hey, I should 30 years ago this month, people were saying no one's going to watch Star Trek The Next Generation because they can't find it on their local listings because it's not on a set time. Obviously, that didn't work.
Also, I should point out, CBS All Access has had The Good Fight, which is the sequel to The Good Wife.
The
Good Wife, on for over a year and has renewed it.
Mm-hmm.
And there, it does have a lot of CBS backlist on it.
Yeah.
And so it's not just Star Trek.
I mean, I finally watched all those episodes of JAG I haven't seen.
Yes.
Yes, but maybe not you, but maybe someone else can.
Yeah, but and they are not overcharging for it at this point. The question is, when the consumer, which is all that matters to us out there, when the consumer is already talking about cutting the cord on cable because things just cost way too much. We're moving from being gouged by cable carriers to being nickeled and dimed by...
I just realized something.
Yes?
That the majority of the friends on my social media that were complaining about paying for CBS All Access, a lot of them are the same ones that have cut the cord on cable and are watching
things on Hulu. Yeah, well, that's the alternative.
They already are watching things on Hulu and Netflix.
And guess what? If they subscribe to Amazon, which is almost a freebie because you get so much more.
Yeah, I have Prime, so yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I see it as a free service, actually. But yes, it's one of the things I subscribe for. So between Amazon and Netflix and Hulu, and now you have individual production companies or carriers, individual carriers of things for other production companies, then you're going to end up paying about as much as you would for that megalith cable channel.
You know what? I want to see The Handmaid's Tale. I really want to see it. won a lot of awards. But you know what? I've got Amazon Prime.
Mm-hmm.
I've got Netflix. I'm not really inclined to, like, chip
another 8 a month
for another service.
The other thing
is, I'll go with you on that. I have a number of streaming services, and every time I add a new one, chasing down one particular show, which I have done, like with Murdoch Mysteries, my attitude is, oh crap, why can't this all be on Netflix?
Yeah, and Murdoch Mysteries.
Why can't there be one streaming service that has all the shows? And that, it just doesn't work that way, unfortunately. I think it will eventually.
No, but there are the differences between channels that are conglomerates. By the way, one that I subscribe to is Acorn, which is excellent and has a lot of good stuff.
BritBox, including Murdoch Mysteries.
Including Murdoch Mysteries. But that's where I discovered Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries.
Right.
And
it's primarily BBC stuff, isn't it?
No.
Murdoch is CBC.
A lot of it is IBC, as in I as in hello. It's Australian. Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries is Australian. Newton's Law, which is the same producers and writers as Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries, which is quite good, is on Acorn, is Australian. There's also Janet King and Cordy's, and there's a couple of other decent Australian series. There's at least one South African series. So Acorn...
Basically stuff from people who speak English but not here.
Yes, and they don't speak it as good as
they don't talk so good.
When they speak, they don't speak the Queen's English, and by the Queen's English, I mean like Flushing or Jackson Heights.
Right.
There's one other thing to think about too: is the amount of social media that people complaining about. I'm not going to pay that. There are people who want to see it but don't want to pay that. They're not people who don't want to see the show. Otherwise, they wouldn't be complaining in the first place.
And also, the people who complain tend to be more vocal on social media than the people who don't.
There is that in the whole silent majority argument there. And also,
as I've said many, many times, don't mistake a bunch of people bitching on the internet for any kind of trend.
I also think that depends,
except when you know the people in person.
Some of the people that I know in person, the most likely are going to wait and then binge it all at once.
Yeah, yeah.
Or they're going to get fed up with it being talked about and want to know what's going on.
Yeah, one of the two. And social media, this is yet another trend that we haven't even discussed, because now you have YouTube, not YouTube Pro, but YouTube has a package deal that for like $20 a month, you're getting something like 36.
I think it's called YouTube Red.
No,
YouTube Red is something else altogether.
Oh, is it?
No, YouTube Red is getting YouTube and Google Play Music and some other things combined without any commercials. I am a charter subscriber to Google Play Music.
I'm talking about going
onto YouTube and watching NBC.
Right.
Yeah. And I keep getting ads,
when I go onto it the first time, do you want to, and it shows up as a pop-up,
yeah,
do you want to do this? And I keep on saying no.
No, this is brand new. This is under 2 months old.
Yeah, in the last 2 months.
And other social media carriers are going to be doing exactly the same thing, as in the PS2 channel. That is forthcoming. They will have shows that you cannot get on an Xbox.
Right.
You know, and things like that. So it's all becoming fragmented, incredibly fragmented, where... sooner or later, somebody's going to say, you know, I'd like cable back. Thank you.
Yeah, that's it. You were talking about being nickeled and dimed to death when you start to put together all the channels that you want to watch, and yet you crunch the numbers, you say, you know, I'm better off paying the cable price.
Yeah. Because I would love to cut the cable, but somebody mentioned it earlier. The channel that goes on when I turn on my TV is TCM. That is, you know, Turner Classic Movies has all of the politics I care to see. and other things I can get other ways. If it wasn't for TCM, I would have gotten rid of my cable by now, because I do get some. I get a lot of programming. I get 6 hours a day of my programming for free, commercial free on YouTube, and that's called Safari Live. By the way, everybody should. It just ended 20 minutes ago. The morning, the morning drive is just over. It's on twice a day, 3 hours a day. It's exactly what the name says. It's a live safari on the back of Jeeps with, you know, great photographers. And it's, I think, the only really great reality show on TV.
Yeah, but if you could just buy just that TV show and not the whole channel, what would you want to do? I mean, there are some cases there are channels that, I would get.
Well, this is a free channel I'm talking about.
But I would get, like, I want to see Doctor Who. I have to have BBC for that.
Or BritBox.
Or BritBox, yeah. And so I have to buy either.
It's the
and,
same.
And BBC America is part of most basic packages.
Not all of them.
Not all of them.
Word most encompassed not all.
Yes.
For Optimum, it's not. It's an additional one because we have to pay additional for it.
And
Optimum.
What's fascinating about this is, you know, the watching everything change. I mean, just how much the landscape has changed in the last 10 years, in the last 15 years, the last 20 years. Same thing's happening in publishing too. There's just so many different options that have started happening.
Such as,
just in terms of you know the rise of the small press, the rise of self publishing. Which has increased options for writers as well, and options for readers. And with television, you're seeing the same thing. There's so many different levels at which, so many different sources for production of TV shows.
And it's also true, by the way, very much extrapolating from what you're saying of podcasts.
Yeah.
That there are very few clearinghouses. You know, Apple wanted to be it. That's why they called it a pod. So the iPod
would be the
other. Yeah. There were webcasts until Apple got involved, and then it became a podcast. That's in the history of technology.
Yep.
But I see your point. I will argue, however, that when it comes to publishing and small presses and books and things like that, the purveyors, the carriers of that, are they're easy to find. And again, you can and there's of course one megalithic whole, as in Whole Foods, one entire company that encompasses most of them and carries their own competition.
Yeah.
And so they're easy to find, and if you can't find it at Megalith Incorporated, named after the Megalith River in Brazil, if you can't find it there, then Google it.
Yeah.
And you can find
the other Megalith.
And there's a very good search engine, by the way, for podcasts. Well,
there's I would consider there's two major situations from the production side. There's CreateSpace, and then there's Lightning Source, so...
Mm-hmm.
Wherever you want to go.
The point being,
but your point.
There's so many different, and it's, that is good for the consumer generally. The fact that they're and I don't blame CBS for trying to monetize it as best they can, simply because that's kind of what we're all trying to do to some extent or other.
I'm not convinced
that their method will work.
Yes,
but if they're gonna try it, Star Trek was the right franchise to try it with.
I will agree with
you. Yeah. I think you know that they want to try and you know have their cake and eat it too, or the other way around, and so.
But I would say again, you know, taking my position as a consumer, that you know people vote with their pockets,
and
as John will say, they will say, we'll find out. But there are some things that you don't know, that you might experiment with, and if you find out and it fails, you could be killing that thing.
I don't think it will. Star Trek has survived worse.
As our friend Kim Kindia was so fond of saying, Star Trek, you can't kill it with a stick.
We tried.
We
had a stick.
That is one franchise with which it is true. One with which it is not true, for example, you mentioned BBC America or the BBC for that matter. Doctor Who, if they had made a really, really, really dumb move, which they are capable of doing.
Oh, yes, they are.
Doctor Who could be killed.
Already has been once.
Well, repeatedly. Yeah, but
let
that,
me jump in here because you just said Star Trek is the franchise that can't be killed. Let me point out that Akiva Goldsman was involved in the death of another franchise. That would be the Batman franchise.
It didn't kill it.
It's back.
Oh, yes, he did.
Well,
it's Robin. Back.
No, it's re-risen, and in ways I really don't like.
It will always come back.
Right.
But
No, we're talking about killing dead, not reappearing.
Okay.
We're talking Gunsmoke dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, all Akiva Goldsman was kill one tie-in franchise, basically. I mean, the Batman movies were derivative works in any case anyway. Comic book never went anywhere, and that's the original source material. You know, the...
Yeah, it never stopped.
Yeah. It, you know, since 1937. So
and slightly over 100,000 people buy an issue every month.
Yeah.
Wow. That's an impressive figure.
No, it isn't.
It used to be a lot more impressive.
I would propose that there is the potential, and here again, I haven't seen the second episode or any subsequent episodes.
The end of the first episode.
For it to go away for another 10 years.
It's never gone away for that long. That, in fact, 10 years is the... Actually, no, it's never been away that long. Counting the animated series? No, it's never been away. It's never been off screen for more than... The animated series ran from 73 to 74.
When did Enterprise end?
2005. And then four years later, a movie came out.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
You know, this maybe influenced me, but I am a big comic fan. I still buy a lot of comic books every week. The price tag on a comic book is now $3.99.
Yeah.
Or $2.99 minimum.
Yeah.
So asking for
you mean
five...
a graphic novel?
No, I don't.
No, I mean a comic book.
No, I know. I'm
graphic novels cost like 20.
Yeah, in hardcover. But
then it costs 40.
Yes, then it costs 40. So the point is, it depends on, you know, compared to that, two comic books will set me back a minimum of $6 right there. Actually, $5.98 if I'm very picky. And so for $5.99, I can get CBS All Access, which is going to give me a lot more
apples
for
and
my
oranges.
$6. Yes, it is. Apples and oranges, but it's consumer dollars. It's competing for my dollar. $6 a month for access?
I dare say that, with your...
I spend $50 a week on comic books.
With your average... pardon me. With your average comic book reader, they are not the same audience as your all-access subscriber. Your all-access subscriber has a name.
Yes, but...
Mommy or Daddy. But whereas it is still mostly teens.
Jim, the average 20s. Age of a comic book reader nowadays is 24.
That's the
mean age. That's half your customers are above 24 and half your customers are below 24.
That depends on
the number of
the
kids buying comic books. They can't, they're not for kids anymore, Jim. They can't afford them.
Well, that's the thing, yeah. I can't afford the comics I've got at home.
Yeah.
And they were 12 cents.
Yes.
That's yeah. Well, there's another story there.
Yes.
Lister isn't here yet. We're actually, we would be over in 15 seconds, would be the end of our show, because we have to play our outro music, of course.
Of course.
And I have to make announcements, but... we can keep on talking, but I want to repeat some of the various announcements I had at the beginning for those people who didn't tune in. Number one, this coming Monday from 3 to 5 p.m., join me with James Ursay and Janet Coleman as we discuss 150 years between the three of us of working at WBAI, the joys and the torture. And on Tuesday at 7 p.m. here at 388 Atlantic Avenue on the ground floor, admission free, donations cajoled. The New York Review of Science Fiction readings featuring Gardner Dozois and Michael Swanwick. A really great lineup, if I say so myself. I haven't fully booked November yet. It is half booked, and December will be all musical. So science fiction writers who perform and perform well will be performing music.
Wow, that's just
so
weird.
Led by Sarah Pinsker. So, there are a lot of good people that will be on stage there. So, yeah, so we've been spending a lot of time. I've been talking, oh, there's Lister. I've been talking on several episodes of this show with both Dan and Terrence Taylor about the other form. And this is one, I'll have to tell you, we'll see how Discovery plays out over 15 episodes. But one of the things that I really like about the new form, and Netflix has finally started learning this with their Marvel shows, 8 is a really glorious number. It worked very well for the Defenders. As far as I'm concerned, Luke Cage, ended when they killed Cottonmouth. You know, I didn't need Diamondback. That was 8 episodes. That was really
actually
good.
The Defenders is the least watched of all the Marvel movies.
Well,
I agree with you creatively.
Excuse me, you have no idea of that. It's a Netflix show. You don't know. Nobody knows. Hollywood Reporter doesn't know. Variety doesn't know. I'd like to know how you know that. Marvel doesn't know.
Well, Marvel probably does know.
No, actually, Marvel doesn't know. It's in the contract.
Really?
Yeah, I do follow Hollywood Reporter very closely.
Okay, that makes sense for Marvel to agree to that, but all right.
Netflix knows.
Yeah.
They are the producer. And they're working with Jeff Loeb, but they produce the show, they own the show, and they give as much information about that as they do about any of their other shows, which is nil. It's controversial.
Variety did an article a week ago saying that it was the least viewed by Marvel's series in its debut month in the U.S.
Okay, I don't know how Variety has that. I have a contact there.
Mm-hmm. Go find out.
I can ask. Hollywood Reporter said otherwise.
Jim, I do want to say that you did give me permission to pitch David to plug
David
Max.
Yes.
upcoming Star Trek Discovery movie.
Not upcoming, it's out. Desperate Hours.
Novel. Today. Desperate Hours. It was out today.
There will be an upcoming one.
It's in stores now.
By Dayton Ward.
Okay. Ren, where can we next find you? At what con will you be visible?
And which ones will you be invisible?
Probably PhilCon will be the next one I'll be at. I'm stopping by New York Comic Con just to see it.
Okay, and I'll be at Capclave next week.
Yeah, I'm not doing Capclave now.
Yeah, I love Capclave. It's my second favorite.
I need to get to it. It's the amount of needing a break from other conventions that we go to.
Yeah.
But I think PhilCon is my next one I'm definitely going to be at.
PhilCon is a very good con, let me tell listeners. You're in the listening area. Yeah. It's a lot of fun. It's a little anemic in a couple of ways, but that doesn't mean if you go that you won't have a wonderful time.
And Shauna McGuire is the author guest of honor.
Oh, and
I expect to be hanging out
with
Shauna.
So is Grant,
okay.
By the way.
Keith,
I expect to be hanging out with Shauna.
Ren, our show is over. It's after 3 a.m. Keith. What are your most current books?
My most recent books are an omnibus called Thor: Tales of Asgard, which is an omnibus of my trilogy of novels featuring Thor, Sif, and the Warriors Three, the Marvel characters. That's just out now from Joe Books, just in time for the release of Thor: Ragnarok. Yes, that's deliberate. And also, my most recent new book is the Orphan Black coffee table book called Classified Clone Report, which is a reference guide to Orphan Black.
How about a standalone? I mean, not standalone. How about a non-tie-in? How about
the next one that should be out will be the next Precinct book, which is called Mermaid Precinct.
The Precinct books, let me tell everybody. Did you like Piers Anthony? I thought you did. Read Keith R.A. DeCandido's Precinct books.
Mermaid Precinct will be out.
Is that a fair evaluation?
I'll take it.
Dan, aside from Hour of the Wolf, where do we find you?
Despite rumors to the contrary, neither CineFantastique nor the Monster Channel are dead. That's about all I can say about that. Things are hopefully going to be happening and hopefully soon.
Okay. And what you have, and John.
I just wanted to say that it suddenly occurred to me that my first appearance anywhere as any sort of science fiction commentary was on a show hosted by Keith R.A. DeCandido. Who I'm now sitting and across from.
That's true. But you know what, gang? It's after three.
Let's stop.
It is time to stop.
Okay.
So thank you. I said this should have been a 5-hour show because we didn't even get a chance to do listener calls. So you know what? Let's do this again as Discovery starts winding down.
Okay.
Sounds good.
I've been talking.
Okay.
Morning,
thank you, Dan. Thank you, Ren. Thank you, Keith. Thank you, John. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
I was about to say that myself. thank me, Jim. And I will be back with Hour of the Wolf next week from 1 till 5 a.m., except I'm not going to do it all the way, Lister. You're going all the way right now. I should have put you on Facebook Live, but... you saw Madeline Flieger? Yes, she was here last week. Yes, of course you saw her. Yes, Jesus, man. and she certainly saw you. She will be, I think she will be hosting your show next week. What she's doing, I don't know. I'm giving her free rein.
Me too.
Okay, cool. So, absolutely. That's it. You're going to have to come in and entertain her during the show. Thank you, everybody, for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. You can find me in the Hour of the Wolf Facebook group or at OurWolf.com, which is pretty whatever. And we will, as I said, we'll be back next week. I'll be back next week three times, actually, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. So hope you'll be hearing from me then. In the meantime, good morning, and everybody, please be good to each other. Take care.
Tune to radio station WBAI 99.5 FM New York, WBAI.org, not just from the planet Earth, but the entire universe. Thank you very much, Jim Freund. Yeah.
Last words on my lips.
atmosphere. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the fish. The red, white, and blue spit on you.
This is one of the most controversial records ever existed in a Peerless USA to be played on radio or not to be played on radio, called Burn, Baby, Burn.
Red, white, and blue, I'm not Captain America, too black, too strong, causing mass hysteria, trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth, put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth that's off the way I see it while I'm going off? Cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too. And drag it and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Just a mother in it. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why
solo learning. Strike a match to the American flag.
Yeah. 99 single list alive, burning the imperious red, white, and blue. Not kneeling, not sitting down, but burning the imperious red, white, and blue to ashes. Globalizing it, making it popular around the world, why not? If the football players were really serious, they'd burn the imperious red, white, and blue. Burn, baby, burn, right? Yeah. Yep, it's interesting, this whole thing. It's fascinating, you know what I mean? Yep. It's so fascinating.